think that's the idea.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and open up the Senate Judiciary Committee for the interim. What we're going to be doing today is going to be joining with the House for an open informational hearings, but prior to that, in the process of moving committee bills forward, we're going to have a work session, so I'll open up a work session on LC 57. And the purpose of the work session is to introduce the legislation so it can be filed as committee bills, and we'll be ready for the mini session in February. So the chair will take a motion on LC 57.
So, Mr. Chair, I move, is it introduction of LC 57 into the Senate Judiciary Committee for consideration?
As a committee bill.
As a committee bill.
Senator Dingfelder moves LC 57 for consideration as a committee bill for the purpose of moving it into the mini session that's scheduled for the month of February in 2010. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And regarding LC 39.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 39 for consideration as a committee bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee for the February session.
Senator Dingfelder moves LC 39 as for consideration as a committee bill for the mini session that's scheduled for February 2010. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Now, what I want to say, that process was just the procedure to get these bills moving forward. For everyone that has interest in either of those two LC drafts, I expect that we will have more. We will definitely have more discussion, and there will be some modification. I will expect that these two bills will be up for a public hearing in the February session. If not the first day, definitely by the second day. So please keep in touch. And if those who are let's say interested and maybe concerned as to the language that's in the LCs at this point, you should contact staff or myself. With that, Anna, do we need to do anything else before we go into the informational?
Nope, that's it.
Okay.
You need to close the work session?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and close the work session for the Senate on the bill introductions and open the Senate for our informational hearings with the House.
And I'm opening the House portion of it for the informational hearings.
Anna?
Thank you, Mr. Chairs. We have an informational meeting on House Bill 2491. It expands DUI to include any substance that adversely affects a person's physical or mental faculties to a noticeable degree. We have invited testimony. We have Chuck Hayes and several other people on this panel. I believe Chuck Hayes will come up and introduce everyone. Thank you, Mr. Chairs.
Thank you, Chuck. Why don't you call it up and bring whoever else you'd like to have come with you.
And I just would announce to the committee that Eric Rhodes has submitted some testimony that's in your folder. He was a victim of a person who was under the influence, hit his car, severely injured him, put his brother, who is incapacitated for life, out of this accident anyway, and there's information in there about that. He contacted me, but it was too late to get him for testimony today.
Good morning, Chair Pozanski and Chair Barker and members of the committees. For the record, I'm Chuck Hayes, the chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. And I'm here today talking about House Bill 2491, which was a bill from our previous legislation. And also testifying with me today, I have Jody Vaughn to my right, who is also a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, and then District Attorney Rob Beauvais from Lincoln County. We also have testimony this morning from Courtney Pock, a traffic safety resource prosecutor from Washington. Also Dr. Andy Nichols from Roseburg. And then we've also invited Senior Trooper Mike Ewy from the Oregon State Police to come in this morning and give us some statistical information. This was a bill that came up for a hearing in our last legislation and carried over until the interim. And what we're looking at and with this bill is trying to redefine the definition of intoxicant as it pertains to the DUI statute, ORS 813-010. Currently, under that statute, a person in Oregon can only be convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants if it involves liquor, a controlled substance, and or certain inhalants. And our statute in Oregon, as you know, does not include other impairing substances. And the majority of the states around the country now have enacted wording in their DUI statutes that include either any drug or any substance or any intoxicating substance. In fact, if you look at those states, Oregon is kind of in the minority there, that we are still a controlled substance state only. The reason for the majority of the states going to this wording that includes any drug or any intoxicating substance is because we are seeing an increase of people or incidents involving impaired driving, where drivers are driving and impaired by other substances that go beyond our definition or the limits in our definition. In fact, if you look at the neighboring states around us, California and Washington, Idaho, even Colorado, Montana, places like that, they are all states that have incorporated the any drug in their definition. In fact, doing some research, Washington has actually had their law that indicates any drug in place since 1979. And if we look and see what is happening nationwide, and not only here in our state of Oregon, well, we're starting to see more of these incidents that are involving substances that go beyond our current limitation in our statute. It doesn't look like it's going to get any better either, because if you take a look at some of the statistical information which I have provided for you in my written testimony, you can see that the prescription drug problem in Oregon is worsening along with many other states around the country. And so officers now are starting to see more of these cases involving non-controlled substances. In fact, you're going to hear some examples this morning. I have three of them. And I think you'll also hear some other testimony where drivers were arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants and treated as a DUI, only to have these cases later dismissed or not filed because they did not meet the criteria. Case number one that I have in your written testimony, in my written testimony for you, is a 52-year-old driver, who was stopped after being reported as an impaired driving near Sheridan. The complainant reported that the driver nearly hit a guardrail, was all over the road, and was speeding up and down and slowing down for no apparent reason. When stopped, the driver was visibly impaired and unable to actually complete the roadside field sobriety test. A breath test revealed the presence of no alcohol, and the driver admitted taking six different prescription medications. Five of those medications were non-controlled. The person was arrested, and a urine sample was obtained, which is customary here in Oregon, and the toxicology result indicated non-controlled substances only. In case number two, a 33-year-old driver was involved in a crash, and when officers arrived at the scene, the driver was actually stumbling into the traffic and appeared highly intoxicated. The driver there was unable to even perform the field sobriety test at roadside and admitted taking five different prescription drugs, all of which were non-controlled. A breath test in this case also failed to reveal the presence of alcohol, and a toxicology test confirmed two different non-controlled substances. That driver was charged with driving under the influence but could not be prosecuted. And then the third case is a 49-year-old driver who was reported by a citizen as a possible impaired driver in Lincoln County. The driver reportedly made a bad pass, nearly caused a head-on collision, and forced an oncoming vehicle into the ditch. When officers located the vehicle, the driver was actually straddling the center line and was halfway into the oncoming lane of traffic. The officer made the traffic stop. The person was highly intoxicated. She admitted to consuming a small amount of alcohol and had a breath test of a 0.03%, and then also admitted using prescription drugs, some of those being non-controlled. And the toxicology in that case also confirmed the presence of two non-controlled drugs. So these are just three examples, and as I said, you might hear some more this morning as well. But when you look at these cases and you hear and look at other cases that we're experiencing here in Oregon, the drivers in these cases are just as dangerous as someone that would be highly intoxicated on alcohol or any potentially impairing drug that is a non-controlled drug, such as Valium or Xanax or Vicodin or any of those drugs that we commonly hear about in some of these impaired driving cases. So as I said earlier, I've given you some information about the drug problem, and you might hear more about that this morning. But just as an example, emergency room visits related to non-medical use of pharmaceuticals, including prescription and over-the-counter drugs, has increased 21% from 2004 to 2005. And then accidental deaths involving prescription drug abuse have increased by 114% since 2001 to 2005. And then if you look here in Oregon, what's happening with us here, the Department of Human Services reports that Oregon ranks in the top 10 for the annual abuse of prescription drugs for all ages. And then we also rank in the top 10 for the abuse of prescription drugs by youth ages 12 to 17. What House Bill 2491 does is it revises the definition of intoxicants so that we can look at these other drugs and include these other drugs that are causing problems for us. And what I've done in my written testimony, I've got three attachments there, but attachment C also shows you some of the drugs that we are commonly experiencing now that cannot be prosecuted, or we cannot prosecute for DUI, that are being detected in the crime laboratory. And the majority of those are prescription drugs and have the potential abuse and for causing impairment. I think if we were able to pass this and get this added to our definition for DUI and add this to the definition of intoxicant, it would assist us not only in dealing with a problem that we have on the road with impaired driving, but it would also help us to educate the public about the potential dangers of prescription drugs, which I think we're all concerned about and should be concerned about. But it would also assist us in identifying persons who need drug treatment or need some sort of intervention in their life. Because the majority of the cases that we're seeing, and you'll hear about some of those, as I said, these are people that are abusing these substances. They're not just using them therapeutically like they are supposed to be doing. They get directions just like you and I do when we go to the drugstore to pick up a prescription, and the warnings are there. And those warnings are specific, telling them not to mix and match these, not to use them with alcohol, but yet we tend to see this. And these are the people that we are encountering on the road, the officers are encountering, the ones that are abusing those drugs. So it would help us in regards to that, I think, with that education. What House Bill 2491 does not do, it does not advocate or suggest the non-use of prescription drugs or over-the-counter medications. In fact, we are advocating the responsible and proper use of all drugs, especially those that can impair a person's ability to operate a vehicle safely. And it will not require the Oregon State Police Crime Laboratory to do anything different than what they're doing now, because as you can see from that list that I provided you, they are routinely looking for these non-controlled drugs, and they report these non-controlled drugs back to law enforcement, so it will not cause them to do any additional work. And then I think also that this bill, it will not create any additional liability to physicians or pharmacists or people who dispense these drugs, because the same would apply now to those doctors and physicians who write a prescription for Vicodin or oxycodone or Valium or some of those other drugs that are potentially impairing. So the same would apply there. And then again, it gets back to the responsible use. And then lastly, this bill would not change any procedures as far as a DUI arrest. Officers would still be required to go and develop their probable cause to make the arrest through the field sobriety test, through the interview with the suspect, and then collect their evidence. The only difference would be now is if one of those substances, or if the substance is only detected in a biological sample or the toxicology comes back as a non-controlled drug, we would not have to dismiss the case. It could go ahead and proceed through the judicial system and then work its way through that system as it should. So in summary, the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, which I represent, we strongly urge the committee's support on this bill, and we believe that it's a critical step needed to help reduce drug-impaired driving incidents in Oregon and then make our roadways safer. So having said that, I will, unless you have questions for me, that concludes my testimony, and I'll turn it over to Jody Vaughn.
Why don't we go ahead and do the panel, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me here today. What I'd like to express to you is that I've been prosecuting drug-impaired drivers since 1987, and when I was a young prosecutor starting out, what I mostly saw were alcohol-related offenses, and very rarely would we find cases where the officer couldn't determine what was causing the impairment. And what I wanted to share with you today is a case that happened in Deschutes County on July 13, 2009. It was 5:36 p.m. It was on a Monday evening, so it's during the heavy commute time between Bend and Redmond. And Highway 97 is a four-lane road, two lanes running north and two lanes running south. And during the commute times, it's much like the traffic that you would see on I-5 corridor between Salem and Portland. In this particular case, 911 received four separate phone calls from civilians indicating that there was a driver who was tailgating, passing unsafely, was driving in the center turn lane, which would be the inside median, and also driving to the outside median back and forth. Two of the drivers were interviewed, and both of them expressed their concerns that someone was going to be killed or there was going to be a major crash. Law enforcement, of course, was dispatched. This driver made it through the city of Redmond without hitting anyone and was stopped north of Redmond at the O'Neill Junction. When the officer was contacted him, turns out he was 26 years old, and he just was not in his right mind. And I wanted to share with you just a couple of things that he said to the officer so you could have some understanding of what law enforcement deals with. When the officer asked him about his driving, this gentleman said he didn't know what he was talking about and laughed. He said that someone did call into 911 about him. It was an old woman, and she knew that she couldn't have him, and that's why she was complaining. He also stated that there was a male that wanted to look just like him, and then he changed his mind to say that the 911 caller was a girl. So he was totally not there. He didn't have a shirt on. He sat there and he flexed his muscles, just like trying to show the officer how good looking he was. So this is a person who was clearly impaired by what he was consuming. He failed the field sobriety test. A drug recognition evaluator was called, and he did go through the 12-step analysis. Both officers believe this person was under the influence of a substance. The intoxilizer test was a .00. This gentleman did give a urine test, and the result was positive for Flexerol, which is a non-controlled prescription drug. And therefore, our office could not file a DUI charge against him for his conduct. Reckless driving charges were filed. But the problem with that is a conviction for reckless driving, as you all know, doesn't bring a mandatory treatment, and it doesn't count necessarily against a request for diversion later on. And so this is a person who could have caused serious injury, could have killed someone without even knowing what he was doing. This is not an uncommon case. We see these cases in the Deschutes County DA's office, and I saw them when I worked in Clackamas County and in Josephine County. And the reason I wanted to share this with you is to give you some idea of what these drugs are doing to people. This young man basically told the officer that he didn't take anything and that he was not under the influence of any medication. There was no indication that he had a prescription for this drug. And also, the other thing that's most concerning, that he was driving without a license and without insurance. And so these are the people that law enforcement are seeing. These are the cases that we see in our office. And we're asking that the law be changed to accommodate our society as it is now. Unfortunately, it's changed since the 80s. But we'd like to be able to respond to these situations before serious injury or death occurs. And I always tell people that DUI, one of the best things about it is stopping people from doing something worse. It's an occasion to give us a chance to sort of let them know their behavior is not acceptable. So that's all the comments I have.
Chair Przanski, Chair Baker, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, Lincoln County District Attorney. I don't have a whole lot to add to what you've heard, just a couple of quick points. One is, the good news is that our federal government and the pharmaceutical industry spends literally billions of dollars to research and bring to the market better and safer drugs. Going along with that is the fact that many of these new classes of drugs are not being added to the controlled substance schedules because they don't need to be, and that's all good because they're safer. The problem with that is, of course, is we have whole new classes of drugs and many drugs that are being prescription drugs or even over-the-counter drugs that are simply not dealt with as you've heard described. The second thing that goes along with that is that with the exception of one drug, Oregon is tracking with the national trends in terms of drug abuse. We're tracking lockstep with the nationwide trends, in particular with prescription drug abuse, which has been growing quite largely over the past decade. And so the concern here is really, and this is the way I distill it down to, we really need to modernize our DUI statute. We're not looking at alcohol and controlled substances anymore. We really have a whole third new category of pharmacopoeia that's out there that is impairing people's ability to safely drive. And these prescription drugs carry the warning, the label warning, don't drive, don't operate machinery, but people are still using and abusing them and on our roads and driving unsafely. So I would strongly encourage you to pass this bill or something like it so we can have a modern DUI statute.
Thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel?
I had just one brief one. With the crime lab, screens for that, do they do a quantitative screen so they know how much somebody's taking?
Chair Barker, I checked with the crime lab, and they do not. Right now, they're just giving us a positive whether or not it's there or not. Now, the crime lab does have cutoff levels for various drugs, and so I do not know if the, what the cutoff levels are. In the past, you know, if someone was using a substance that was at a therapeutic level, you may not get a positive toxicology. So as far as a quantitative, giving us how much, they do not do that now.
Okay, thank you. And a follow-up on that.
Chuck, do you know if they're planning on modifying? I mean, or what type of gauge are we going against compared to what is happening in other parts of the country?
Chair Pozanski, from my days working with the Oregon State Police and being familiar with the crime lab, we've talked about that for a long time. And the reason that mainly that they're not able to do that is because it does take a little extra time. However, there have been discussions, and those discussions, I believe, are still continuing to this day, as are discussions also about someday looking down the road at blood analysis instead of urine. So those are all things that as times are changing, as District Attorney Beauvais has mentioned, that they're looking at.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you all very much. And Chuck, who else did you want to bring?
The next three, if I could, would be Courtney Pop, Traffic Safety Resource Prosecutor from Washington, who's going to talk about the Washington law, and then also Dr. Andy Nichols, Emergency Room Physician from Roseburg, and then Senior Trooper EY from the State Police.
Great. Thank you.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee. My name is Courtney Pop, and I am a traffic safety resource prosecutor in the state of Washington, and I've come to share with you our experience with our drug law. A person is guilty of DUI in Washington state when they are under the influence of intoxicating liquor or any drug. And we've had that law, as Mr. Hayes pointed out, since the late 70s. We have seen an increase as technology and the drug recognition expert program has expanded. We've seen an increase in those cases in our filings in Washington state in every county. And our drug law is defined as any drug, substance, or immediate precursor included in Schedules 1 through 5 of the DEA drug schedule, of course. We also include the definition to expand to any drug that's recognized in the official U.S. pharmacopoeia as well as the homeopathic pharmacopoeia. Any substance intended for use in the diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease in human beings or animals, substances other than food, minerals, or vitamins intended to affect the structure or any function of the body of human beings or animals. So it's a very broad definition. We also include anything that would be a component of those listed above. However, in Washington, there is no per se limit. We do not have an automatic limit for a drug if it's located, and we do also blood tests, so it's somewhat different than your urine testing. You have to have an amount and a proof of impairment, and I think when we talk about our Washington drug law, that is key. I actually did I have my own experiences, but I, before coming, did a survey of prosecutors from around our state to solicit their input as to what they're seeing. We find that the impairment requirement really does provide protection to both the citizens, the drivers, who are suspected of being impaired, as well as prosecutors have this automatic check. It eliminates any danger of a driver being prosecuted for DUI with only, you know, what would be, I don't like to use the word therapeutic amount because that may be impairing depending on what the substance is, but it protects people from being prosecuted, you know, the mother who takes one reasonable amount of cold medication and gets in her car. If an officer can't prove that that has been impairing this person, he or she would not be prosecuted in Washington state. In Washington, possessing a valid prescription of any drug is not a valid defense against vehicular homicide or assault or DUI. And jurors, based on their own personal experiences, are able to understand when the prosecutor brings to them and discusses what you've heard from other members testifying today, is that the drugs that we commonly see, they do come with warning labels. They come with informational packets from a pharmacist, and often a verbal warning at the time of a prescription is issued or even an over-the-counter prescription is purchased, that this substance may cause some level of impairment, and particularly when you combine that with even very minute levels of alcohol. And jurors understand that because they typically have either consumed or offered these drugs over the counter to their family members. When we look at the top 10 list of what non-controlled substances are active in Washington cases, it's important to remember that we do not routinely test our blood for all levels. So, for example, if a blood test comes in on a vehicular assault or homicide, and that person is first tested for their ethanol levels, if the alcohol level is over an 08, then likely our toxicology lab would not further test. So these are just the cases that do go further when it is an officer notes impairment, but there's not an immediate indicator of what that substance may be. When we look at the top 10 list, we look at drugs that we're all used to hearing. We're looking at Celexa, Effexor, Benadryl, antidepressants, Prozac, things, Flexeril, which was mentioned earlier, and cough syrup. And these are all things that many of us would have in our medicine cabinets or in our purses, things that we take routinely. And I think it initially is important to note that they are impairing, and we do see these often in levels that they're not people who are taking them appropriately. They're people who are getting behind the wheel of a car who do not have all their faculties about them, and they're causing grave danger to the citizens on our streets. And in Washington, we have no known cases where a pharmacist or a medical provider has been charged or has been civilly liable for furnishing any of these drugs in when the subsequent user resulted in a DUI or vehicular homicide or assault. And I think that it limits the civil liability. Our dram shop law does not extend to drugs. But I think that I know that Washington sees these cases, and I've received, like I said, information from prosecutors all over the state in the last few weeks telling them that I was going to come share with you what our experience was. And every single person responded that they have seen an inordinate increase in these cases. And I think some of that is particularly frightening when what is constantly referenced is they're the very young. We see typically, I think the highest DUIs are in the 16 to 25-year-old male range. Those are often people who are abusing prescription and non-controlled substances because those are readily available to them. And I'm sure you'll hear other testimony about that. But that's our Washington law.
All right, thank you. Let's see. We'll do questions now since we're going to specific areas. We'll start with Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Pop?
Yes.
We talked about this before, and how does Washington State, I can remember back to an experience I had where I took cough medicine and on a long trip from my girlfriend's house back to college, and that was very, I didn't realize it was stupid. So my question is, how does Washington State, how do you, you know, if it's unintentional, it's, I haven't read the new bill, draft bill, but do we put in there knowingly abused, or how does Washington State?
No, we look at just, it's not a knowing, if you have the drug in your system, you could be liable to be charged with DUI. But of course, an officer looks at the totality of the circumstances before citing for that, as well as the prosecutor would then be reviewing the case. And typically, what we hear and what my experience has been is that if I get a case, I read the facts, I see who I'm talking about, what is this person's experience. And in generally in the case, unless you were driving very erratically and or, you know, caused an accident or some other thing that doesn't sound like a case that we would typically prosecute. And I will say it's an area where people are very cautious. There isn't, I can assure you that at least in Washington, there is not an overabundance of cases where we are going after the typical, you know, I consumed one appropriate dose of Robitussin. However, it's the same in Washington. We could, I mean, if you were under reckless driving, if you were asleep at the wheel, it would be the same. That may not have been your intention, but if you were doing that, you would also be charged.
Just one statement, Mr. Chair. That's not, and I'm not trying to protect anyone that's knowingly abusing. That's, and we've had a testimony last session about this. But I hope there's something in here that protects that one person that made a stupid decision that doesn't go on his record. I wouldn't be here if I had an accident and had a DUI on my record for taking cough medicine because I, you know.
Exactly. Right, and one example that I could share with you is, you know, we had a driver who was in her 60s, and she had no previous history of any contact with the law at all in Washington or any other state. And she was stopped after a report of erratic driving in a residential area. And when contacted, it was clear that something was not right with this woman. She failed the field sobriety test and seemed to be out of it. And the officer then submitted her blood test for review for all drugs. It was reviewed, and it turned out that she had a variety of non-controlled substances that had been prescribed to her recently within the prior 2 weeks. And the prosecutor, when he received this case, then was contacted by her attorney, and the attorney presented that information. And as I stated, that it's not an automatic defense if you have a prescription. However, all of that information does come in. It turns out that this woman was experiencing what is common when people are given a variety of drugs, and she was having an adverse reaction. And so rather than prosecute that woman, they essentially put her on, I guess it would be an informal type diversion. And they had her go back to her doctor, discuss what had happened. Her family became involved through her attorney. They worked with a prosecutor in order to get her on a regimen that was more appropriate and set in some checks and balances. She was living on her own and didn't have anyone else to assist her. And then in 3 months, when it was obviously resolved and there were no issues, she had voluntarily agreed to do a drug and alcohol substance abuse treatment evaluation. When it was determined there were no issues, that case was then just dismissed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question for Ms. Popp. I didn't see any testimony, but are you finding incidents or higher incidents of combination of prescription drugs and alcohol? Because one of the things that has come to my attention is an increase in especially for young people that obviously can get pharmaceuticals from their parents, cabinets, and then we have a very high rate of underage drinking in Oregon because, you know, we have a relatively low beer tax, so we have cheap beer.
Exactly.
So I'm wondering if you're seeing an increase in that combination.
You just had to work that one in.
I was going
to
say
wherever I can, Mr. Chair. It happens to be true, unfortunately.
Yes, and that is in fact the case. In speaking with our state toxicologist this week, we discussed that it is in fact most common that there would be alcohol on board with these offenders. And typically there's also a combination of all drugs, including alcohol, that a typical defendant screened would have 2 to 5 substances in his or her blood at the time of arrest. So these are people, as you said, young people are often able to, say, steal a six-pack from their mini-mart or convince someone to buy them a small amount of alcohol. They are then able to access prescription medications either in a parent's medicine cabinet or by purchasing a reasonable amount at the store. And so they're combining the two, and we see that with all ages as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I'm always interested in ways that we can prevent rather than prosecute at the end. So are there any ignition interlocks that work with prescription drugs, or do they just work with alcohol?
Currently, we are working on an ignition interlock bill to enhance in Washington, and we have been told repeatedly that it's on the horizon, and the technology is available in some theoretical sense, but it is not currently widely available on the market, unfortunately, which is something we definitely need to have.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I do, Mr. Chair. Okay. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a slight correction, because I have been researching the interlock issue with the help of the legislative staff, and I think actually technology exists that would be applicable in Oregon, and we could use in Oregon, at least in the alcohol side of the situation.
Right. We haven't been able to purchase any of that. We were trying to purchase them in Washington, and they're not available to purchase for drug addiction.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, whoever wants to go next on the panel.
Chip Wazanski and Representative Barker of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Andy Nichols. I'm an emergency medicine physician from Roseburg, Oregon. Just wanted to come here and testify on behalf of this bill. There's a number of drugs that can clearly impair a person's ability to operate a motor vehicle. We see them every day. We give them every day to multiple people. There's a subset of those drugs, both controlled and non-controlled, and a subset of those definitely can impair a driver and make them drive under the influence and definitely cause them to be impaired. These drugs are often prescription, sometimes they're over-the-counter medications. Most of them, as you're aware, have a legitimate use, whether it's your cough medicine or your depression medication. But when they're used inappropriately, it can definitely cause disruption of the normal brain function. A couple of the examples I just want to go over. One of them is Benadryl, and the other would be Robitussin. There are medications that cause significant drowsiness just alone. Routinely, when we give somebody Benadryl in the emergency department, that we make sure that they have a ride home, because we're not going to give them Benadryl and let them drive home, because we know that that alone can cause them to be impaired, very sleepy, drowsy, just the equivalent of somebody who's been up for 24 to 36 hours trying to drive down the road. They definitely have some impairment issues with that. Now, if you combine these with any kind of like alcohol or anything other drugs like that, they work synergistically, and which can cause somebody to get increase their impairment. Then lastly, these two drugs, both Benadryl and Robitussin, are often used by a lot of times teenagers and young adults. I see it most commonly. They use them to abuse them to get high. You can go on the internet and Google any of these, Robitussin, how to get high on Robitussin, how to get high on Benadryl, and it'll tell you exactly how many you need to take and what your experiences are going to be. And I've seen these oftentimes. They have hallucinations. They're confused and combative. It's commonly referred to as robo-tripping. This is kind of the, what they call for Robitussin. You see that quite frequently in the departments. Another one of the medication classes I wanted to briefly mention was just SSRIs, or the serotonin reuptake inhibitors. These are examples of these like Prozac and Celexa, very common taken for antidepressant medications. But the way these work is they interact, they work on the neurotransmitters in the brain. And the alcohol, for instance, acts on those same neurotransmitters. So when you combine these two together, you can have drastically increased impairment. So somebody who takes, who may be on Prozac and just takes a couple drinks can definitely be impaired as somebody who has been drinking all night long and has a very high blood alcohol level. There's a lot of other drugs. I mean, they've mentioned most of them already. And we know that these cause, I mean, it's in the medical literature. Every time we prescribe it in our little Palm Pilots, we can look and see, you know, what those interactions are, cause drowsiness, do not take with alcohol. They're very well listed and very well known in the medical literature. That if you take them inappropriately, it can cause impairment. So, and one of the things that kind of floored me was I was looking at some of the Oregon State Police data, and it showed that there's one person every 24 hours is arrested for impaired driving under the influence of non-controlled substance. It just kind of bothers me that under the current law that they're not going to get arrested. They could probably get off free or not get prosecuted for that. So in conclusion, I just wanted to say that, you know, I don't think these medications need to be removed from the market or don't need to be increasingly controlled, but we can't ignore the problem. Legislation such as this bill, 2491, needs to be in place to send that clear message that driving under the influence of any substance is not going to be tolerated.
I saw that.
And just as a side, you know, I see people all the time in the emergency room and families, and I have to tell them that their loved ones died. I just don't want that to happen anymore, and it has to.
Thank you. Any questions for the doctor? I want to thank you for traveling up, and Ms. Hope, also for you traveling down from Washington.
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair Pozanski and Chair Barker and members of the different committees. My name is Michael Ely. I'm a senior trooper with the Oregon State Police, and I am the Drug Evaluation Classification Program Manager for the state and also the agency's Standardized Field Sobriety Testing Coordinator. I oversee the operation of 180 active drug recognition experts and approximately 37 drug recognition expert instructors. And my attachments, I'm kind of going to move forward. My attachments are a regional map, and it has five different regions on where the DREs are at, and also lists who the region coordinator is out there. And I also gave you a list that identifies who those DRE region coordinators and allied coordinators are. And lastly, I gave you an informational handout on what the drug recognition expert is. So moving along with relative information regarding this bill, when a person is arrested for DUI and has a blood alcohol content lower than a 0.08% or no alcohol whatsoever, but the police officer suspects drug impairment, that's when they notify a drug recognition expert. The drug recognition expert comes out, does a 12-step evaluation. Hopefully they're able to obtain urine that corroborates the opinion of the DRE. The DRE writes up a report, sends that forward to the prosecutor's office. That's a supplemental report to the arresting officer's DUI report. And the hope is that that case will move forward through the adjudication process. Unfortunately, sometimes we know that does not happen. Ultimately, the DRE does render the opinion, though, the opinion of what drug category that person is under the influence of. And oftentimes, it's multiple drug categories. With the current law, the suspect is arrested for a non-controlled substance, which includes prescription over the counter, then the DUI cannot be enforced. 813-010. I'm going to give you a case study that occurred in 2009. A trooper was responding to a driving complaint, multiple calls on this vehicle, vehicles all over the roadway. It was southbound Interstate 5 near Wilsonville. It was a woman operating the vehicle with a small child. Troopers were responding to intercept this vehicle to make a traffic stop when, before they could actually get to that area, the vehicle crashed into a semi-truck. Troopers contacted the driver of the vehicle, passenger vehicle. The driver was not injured. The trooper told me that the driver displayed incomplete and inappropriate responses to basic questions that he was asking regarding the crash. The driver could not stand up without assistance or comprehend what was going on. The driver's speech was disjointed and rambled. In addition, the trooper told me that the driver's demeanor would sporadically change. The driver was, from one time, being on the nod or appearing to be in a euphoric condition or extremely tired with their eyes somewhat closed and their mouth open, to going 180 degrees, becoming very ballistic. Also, the driver was ultimately transported to the hospital because the condition of the driver progressively worsened. Hallucinating, incomplete verbal responses, abnormal vital signs were among several factors. There were more. The interesting note is that two non-controlled substances came back, Paxil and Phenergan, both of which would not fall under the statute for DUI because they're non-controlled, CNS depressants, in fact. In 2007, the Oregon drug recognition experts performed 1,249 drug evaluations. OSP Crime Lab, they confirmed the presence of a non-controlled substance on 256 occasions. And that could be alone or in conjunction with another controlled substance. Of the 256 standing alone for non-controlled substance, they were confirmed 79 times. In 2008, Oregon DREs performed 1,191 drug evaluations. 352 occasions came back positive for a non-controlled substance, either alone or in combination with another controlled substance. Of the 352, it came back confirmed alone for a non-controlled substance 105 times. In 2009, the OSP Crime Lab analyzed 2,425 urine specimens. This includes all kinds of antimortem urine testing, toxicology, including DUIs, proficiency testing, officer-involved shootings, and rapes. Of the 2009 specimens that were analyzed, approximately 90% are a result of a DUI pending case. In closing, if the current DUI statute is changed to incorporate any substance that adversely affects a person's physical or mental faculties to a noticeable or perceptible degree, or a list of a non-controlled substances, there is no expected increase physical because laboratory protocols, testing procedures, and analytical reports would not change, as Mr. Chair Chuck Hayes mentioned earlier regarding a lab. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you all very much for being here today. And Chuck, is there anyone else that you had in your panel before I go along? All right, thank you. The other people that are noted for informational testimony today is the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, so Gail.
Thank you. Chair Spasomsky and Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'd like to put my box of Robitussin up here right now as my Exhibit A. I'll be referring to it in a moment. It's a little lonely up here. We did have a hearing on this bill in the House side in 2009, and present at the podium also expressing concerns about this concept was not only OCDLA, but also the Truckers Association and the ACLU, as well as a mental health advocate. And basically, we're all sort of commenting on the same concern. When you're talking about making something criminal, using a penal law, is there going to be an ability to make sure that this person knows that, in fact, that they are going to be ingesting an intoxicating substance or that some combination of product would actually make them impaired? I'm at a loss a little bit. I don't know if we're really dealing with the original bill as written, which would include any other substance that might adversely affect a person's faculties, or if we're dealing with a more limited bill, which would just be this list of pharmaceuticals, which is attached to Mr. Hayes's testimony as Exhibit C. But you'll notice on Exhibit C that it does include at the bottom the list of the drug dextromethorphan, and there was testimony in the House side in 2009 that that's a common ingredient in cough syrup, and that there had been some cases where someone was very severely impaired with abusive overuse of this cough syrup. But in any event, I did pull my cough syrup off the shelf last night, and this version says right here that it's non-drowsy and that it's alcohol-free. And there's nothing here that would ever advise that if you take more than the prescribed amount, that it would impair you in any way, that your faculties would be affected. It says don't take more than 6 doses within a 24-hour period, but it doesn't say that why. It doesn't say it might harm your kidney as opposed to affect your faculties. So there really is a lack of notice that something as ubiquitous as cough syrup might actually fit within the definition of what it is this bill would apply to. So the question really is, how do we distinguish between the abuser when a penal consequence would be justified versus someone who inadvertently did not know that their faculties would be affected? And there was a comment made by Representative Olson during the hearing, and I think, quite frankly, hit the nail on the head. Really what we're looking at for is to punish criminally the person who abuses user quantities or who has already been warned once and does it again. And that's really, I think, where the penal consequence should come in, and how you affect the person who initially is stopped and didn't know that their faculties were affected by something as ubiquitous as cough syrup. That could be a different response than a criminal response. So I would like to suggest that this is a bill that we can discuss. We haven't done that yet. We haven't had everybody at the table really using their best thinking. There is a psychopharmaceutical aspect of this. I would love to hear from an expert to talk about what is too much, how much do you have to ingest of cough syrup in order to have your faculties affected? I don't know the answer to that, but I think that the simple answers that have been proposed by the proponents, which is simply to list the drugs and fit it within the definition of intoxicants and have penal consequences attached at the front end, might be too big of a sweep. That it can be more calibrated than that and affect really reserve the criminal laws for the person who really is the abuser.
Thank you. Questions?
I would appreciate it. I mean, it sounds like you're saying you'd like to work on this a bit more. And obviously, I'm sure nobody wants a loophole so big you can drive a drunk can drive a 16-wheeler through it with their cough syrup or whatever.
Correct.
And we don't want somebody who innocently takes a prescribed dose of cough syrup. But as the doctor said, he's tired of delivering death messages to families, and I'm sure everybody recognizes that problem. So I would appreciate if you could work with him, and we could get that loophole, if you will, down to a very reasonable size.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I look forward to that opportunity. I really do.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
A question. I suppose I'm conflating bills in my memory, but I seem to recall I remember hearing this in some similar bills in the last session on the House side. I seem to recall that Representative Olson actually did convene something of a mini work group. And I also seem to recall that it got astonishingly complicated very quickly as a matter of drafting a workable bill. Is that a different bill?
It's a similar bill.
A similar bill.
Yeah.
Well, I believe that's everyone we had scheduled for the informational hearing. So with that, I'll go ahead and close the informational hearing on House Bill 2491.
And I'll open an informational hearing on vehicular homicide. We have invited testimony from Doug Perrell, board member of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, Ray Thomas from the firm of Swanson, Thomas & Coon, and Mary O'Donnell. Representative Reed is interested in this bill, and he was not able to be here today.
Mr. Chair, thank you. With your permission, we also have Dean Sigler with us, so what we thought we would do, Mr. Chair, was Ray and I will talk, and then Mary and Mr. Sigler will come up and talk.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. My name is Doug Perro. I'm on the Board of Directors with Bicycle Transportation Alliance. I also chair the Bicycle Transportation Alliance Legislative Committee. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk about this issue. I also want to express our appreciation to Senator Przanski, Chair Przanski, for his work on House Bill 3271 last legislative session. We think that House Bill 3271 takes an important step in terms of holding drivers and the worst of the worst, if you will, in terms of drivers more responsible for their actions on the road. But we think that there is other work that really needs to happen, and we appreciate you taking the time to talk about how we might move forward. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, road users in Oregon are regularly encounter other drivers whose actions and inability to safely operate their vehicles endangers everybody around them. Regardless of whether or not the road user is a motorist, a bicyclist, or a pedestrian, their safety is subject to the whims of an enormous number of other individuals who are driving carelessly and illegally. And we think that the current public policies addressing these issues are ineffective and ineffectual. For far too long, we've accepted the notion that the violent and tragic consequences of these people's actions are just accidents. Investigators of airplane crashes have determined that typically most of those kinds of incidents are not as a result of one single mistake. In fact, the results of airplane collisions typically are a result of a whole string of missteps in terms of the operator's activities. We're confident that if we look at automobile crashes, we'll find exactly the same kind of situation. Most crashes are simply the logical result of the driver's habitual inattention to the serious activity of operating a potentially lethal projectile and driving down the road, overly aggressive behavior, and too frequently, continued driving by individuals who have already demonstrated their inability to safely operate a motor vehicle. And in fact, most transportation professionals do not use the term accident when they talk about collisions on the road. They use the word crash because accident has those connotations of inevitably and just kind of an oops. These are not just an oops. These are the result of somebody who has messed up and repeatedly and is continuing to mess up. And I think some of the testimony that you may have just heard regarding DUII also focuses on that kind of situation, and some of these people just don't care. In Oregon, Motor Vehicles Division says that about 40,000 people are convicted each year of driving suspended or driving revoked. Mr. Chair, that's an average of almost 110 people per day, including weekends and holidays, that are being convicted of driving suspended or revoked. And typically, the Oregon approach to these folks is to suspend them yet again. Some of you may recall the pedestrian that was killed in downtown Salem a couple years ago. He was run over by an individual who had not had a driver's license in 7 years, and in that time had managed to accumulate, I believe it was 15 or 16 suspensions of his driving privileges. Particularly those suspended drivers who have been suspended as a result of driving-related citations. They're among the most dangerous people on our roads. They're twice as likely to violate traffic laws, and they're four times as likely to be involved in a crash. Notwithstanding the danger that these suspended drivers represent to the law-abiding public, the state of Oregon's response typically is to issue yet another suspension of their driving privileges. During just a 5-year period, 1,684 people accumulated 10 or more driving while suspended or driving while revoked convictions. And more than 33,000 received three or more convictions for driving suspended or driving revoked. Yet what do we do when these people get behind the wheel and finally kill somebody? We wring our hands and we issue yet another suspended citation. In 2007, 450 people were killed on Oregon highways. About 0.5% of those people who are in motor vehicles who are involved in a crash die. The fatality rate for pedestrians and bicyclists is about 10 times as high. Undoubtedly, some of the failures resulted in the victim's own carelessness, but too many of them died because of the actions of a driver who had absolutely no business behind the wheel of a motor vehicle. When we ask Representative Reed to introduce House Bill 3399, we hope that that would serve as a discussion of how Oregon could better respond to the serious problem created by these drivers. And we recognize and think we have addressed in our continued work on this issue the legitimate concerns of some other groups that were raised during those discussions. We have surveyed all of the laws of the other states pertaining to vehicular homicide and have developed a proposal based on the approach taken in those other states. And Ray will talk more about that, but just let me very briefly mention that 9 other states have adopted laws that establish sanctions for drivers who kill, but whose actions do not rise to the level of gross negligence currently required. So, Mr. Chair, what we're asking of the committee and what we hope that the committee will do is either take our proposal and move it during the special session, or alternatively, to convene a work group that would involve law enforcement, other safety advocates, and ourselves to take a look at this very serious issue with the idea of being able to move something forward during the 2011 session. As I indicated when I sat down, Mr. Chair, there are 2 members of victims' families that are prepared to talk to you today about their experiences. In the testimony, in the package of materials that we have given you, we have included a copy of a proposed law, just conceptual, a survey of the state criminal statutes with culpability levels that are below the gross negligence for death caused by a motor vehicle, a chart summarizing the vehicular homicide laws in each of the 49 states, a summary of selected state criminal statutes, and the written testimony of not only the 2 individuals that are going to testify after Ray and I are done, but 2 additional individuals as the carnage on our highways continue. So, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'll turn it over to Ray Thomas.
Please.
Thank you.
Chairs, members, staff, folks.
My name is Ray Thomas. I'm a member of the BTA Legislative Committee, and I hope that we've provided you with a useful packet for you to study for yourselves what the laws around the country do to cover situations where people make, by and large, sober but terrible mistakes in judgment when they're behind the wheel of a car. And from my perspective as a lawyer who represents the bicyclists and pedestrians who have been victims of these types of terrible mistakes, I can tell you that we don't do enough. And the reason that we don't do enough is that we focus on the worst of the worst. We focus on those people who are driving recklessly, DUI, driving in the commission of a crime, and we do a quite good job with those folks. But the 4 witnesses who are testifying, 2 in writing and 2 present, are examples of how many people there are where they've lost loved ones and our law just does nothing really to provide serious consequence. Most of the instances that I see do not involve situations where drunk drivers are driving recklessly. They involve people who are bad drivers who take the privilege of driving and subject all of us to great risk, because there are few choices that we make in our lives where we take something as big and heavy as a vehicle, a car, and drive it at highway speeds. The destructive capacity of the decision to get behind the wheel and turn the key and drive that vehicle is awesome, and we don't recognize it very often until we see something that goes wrong. And in the instances that I see, what I see are situations where someone will get a traffic citation or even a careless driving, or maybe even under your hard work, a vulnerable user. And the fact is that there's no probation, there's no threat of any potential jail sentence which is ever going to come and make it so these folks have a motivation to do anything. And in fact, in the instances that form the basis for the testimony today, you'll find that the bad drivers who caused the death of these Oregon citizens, in one instance, paid their fine, never appeared with their mother's credit card. In another instance, two other instances, set in their checks by mail. And these were consequences that may have resulted in some type of a suspension for a careless driving fatality. But literally, there were no consequences for these folks aside from a suspension, which could be the subject of a occupational license that allows the people to get right back on the road. What we're asking for are that these situations, which some folks who are maybe not in the legal system think, well, this is covered by the civil law. Well, let me tell you, from the standpoint of a civil lawyer, most people, if they have insurance at all, have $25,000 in insurance, which is the legal minimum in Oregon for liability coverage. And when a claim is made for a serious injury or death, the fact of the matter is that the defendant has a lawyer hired for them by their insurance company. The plaintiff could have a carrot for a lawyer because the policy limit is paid out. The fact is, Oregon allows somebody who is sued to go bankrupt, and everybody knows that, so the policy limit gets paid. The defendant really doesn't do anything. It's between the insurance company and the estate of the poor person who got killed. What we're asking is that we join the 9 other states who have provided and give us good legal and legislative precedent for an effort to sweep into some type of consequence through either a misdemeanor or a felony conviction, not sending soccer dads to prison or jail, but to have a probationary sentence which makes them provide some restitution, go through some type of a driver's training, do some community service, and have some consequence so the victims, and two of them will testify today, can see that something got done. What we're asking for is that if somebody commits a violation of a traffic law and kills somebody, that there should be a misdemeanor conviction with conditions of probation. Not jail, but something that is going to be a consequence for them. And if they were a suspended driver and chose to get behind the wheel of a car and then killed somebody while they were violating a traffic law, they should have a felony. Not a felony that has a penitentiary sentence, but a sentence that is a presumptive probationary sentence to provide some consequence for them. And the 9 states that we provide to you, there are several tables and an article that I wrote, show you that, for example, the felony provision that we're seeking is almost identical to what has existed for a number of years and has worked quite well in the state of Arizona. Now, Doug told you about a number of some numbers. Well, if you take a look at our most recent 2008 Oregon traffic crash summary, it came out in August of 2009, you won't find these numbers that I'm about to tell you about because we asked ODOT's library staff to provide us with research, and it'll be available to you and your staffers as well. I just found out about it yesterday. I didn't include it in my report. But this is not, by the time you get to fiscal, something that's going to cost the state of Oregon a great deal of money. Because in 2008, the ODOT's data shows that there were 52 fatalities where the driver was charged with a violation and was issued a citation. 52 fatalities. And 30 fatalities where a driver chose to drive while they were suspended. So we're not talking about sending a bunch of people into the criminal justice system. We're talking about a discrete group of dangerous drivers. Not the worst of the worst, but bad enough that we should be doing something about it. And these other states who are discussed in the paper that I've provided and the subject of the charts, which I hope you'll find are helpful, show you how this is a system that is working to protect the citizens in other states and to give the victims of these drivers a sense that maybe something's going to happen as a result of this instead of just nothing, that's going to make it less likely to happen again. Thank you, and be happy to answer any questions.
And I want to thank you for providing those that information, because it's so often somebody will want a law change, and we have to start like reinventing the wheel, and this way we have a wheel already rolling we can take a good look at. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for you, Mr. Thomas, but let me preface my question by saying I really appreciate the work and the rigor that went into this. I appreciate your bringing the bill forward in the last session, and we're trending in the right direction, and I'm confident that when this process is done, I like to think we'll be able to have a workable bill. My question for you, Mr. Thomas, it seems, at the risk of oversimplifying, that there are basically two basic approaches that states do. The first one, which is basically a misdemeanor negligence statute that Hawaii and Nevada do. Utah is sort of an outlier, I think. I'm not going to include. And then the other one is essentially almost a strict liability, i.e. some kind of fatality while a violation is occurring. In your opinion, which do you think is the best approach and why?
Well, Representative Barton, chairs and staff members, I think that my own personal view is that what we need to do is to have a bifurcated law, one that provides a more serious consequence for people who are suspended and choose to drive, because those folks, as you heard from Mr. Perrell, they're the ones who are really just basically disregarding what we've tried to do to get their attention before, and they're launching themselves on the roads that we're trying to drive our kids to school on, ride, and walk upon. For people who just make a serious error in driving, and I don't mean criminal negligence or recklessness, I mean a mistake that they made in violation of the law that caused the death, they should have a misdemeanor. They should have a misdemeanor conviction for it, which includes probation and some terms for them to earn back their driving privileges, and also to provide some showing to the families and to the community that they're taking this seriously. And so that bifurcated approach is one that I would suggest to you.
May I ask a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for that. So I gather if bifurcated law, or perhaps even two laws. The first one modeled, I guess, on Arizona and Nebraska, perhaps a felony even, if the fiscal would allow it. And the other being potentially a misdemeanor. In that, let's pretend the second part of that, the misdemeanor approach. Again, do you prefer the Hawaii-Nevada approach or the violation approach, the strict liability approach?
Well, the approach that we're proposing for Oregon would place us about in the middle of the nine states who have previously provided these laws. The Hawaii approach is one where actually what we lawyers call simple, as opposed to criminal or gross negligence, forms the basis for a misdemeanor without violation of a traffic law, which is actually a lot wider than the misdemeanor that we're suggesting for the state of Oregon. There are other states that, for what we would suggest Oregon has as a misdemeanor, actually make causing a death and violating a traffic law in the course of doing it while having a driver's license, they make that a felony. Our approach is substantially more moderate. It puts us in about the middle of the pack. And if you go to that great legal compendium called Wikipedia, what you will see is that Oregon is one of only three states without a vehicular homicide statute. Now, as in many things, Wikipedia got it wrong. We've actually got a couple of different vehicular homicides, one of which was the subject of the hard work of this group in the last session, and we also had another one called aggravated vehicular, I think, homicide. But those get the worst of the worst, folks. The reason Wikipedia got confused, I think, is because actually if you take a look at what does Oregon do for levels of less than criminal negligence, where somebody is negligent, violates a law, and either has a license or no license, what do we do? Well, we don't have a vehicular homicide statute that covers that. And it's that particular instance that we're seeking that you consider and hopefully find our materials helpful.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Senator Przanski.
Ray, I just want to make something off for the record, since this is part of the record. We actually do have many components that many states have in their vehicular homicide, such as manslaughter for someone that's driving under the influence of intoxicants. So I want to make certain everyone understands we do actually have many of the components that would be commonly found in other states on their vehicular homicide are actually in other statutes. So, and if I could follow up, I just wanted to clarify on the concept for the felony, you'd basically have as a precursor that someone is either revoked or suspended and somehow on their license, and then, of course, all the other facts. As compared for the misdemeanor, it would be basically a violation of a current traffic law and that it resulted in the death of an individual or
that's
in conjunction.
Correct. Chair Przanski and Barker, members and staff, the idea is that the misdemeanor would be for instances where the person did have a driver's license. For the felony, we suggest that you follow the same good drafting that you followed in the provision that you passed last year, such that we satisfy the due process requirements that the person actually know that they're suspended. We don't want to make people subject to a felony where the suspension was in the mail and they didn't get it. But if they intentionally didn't answer their door for 6 months when we've made repeated efforts to deliver the suspension notice to them, well, then that should be something that the courts work through.
And lastly, I guess the other part, Ray, in your presentation you talked about if someone is a defendant in one of these cases and they're convicted, you made the statement that you want them to have to basically earn their right back to be able to regain their license. And I guess I want a little clarification on that, because my understanding at this point, a person who has their license suspended for was involved in an accident that resulted in the death of someone does not have to go through any particular program as much as they have to wait a period of time and then pay the fees, and then if necessary, maybe take the regular test again. But did you have a specific program that you are wanting someone to have to go through? Because if so, I'd like for everyone to know that, because you're talking about needing to probably apply that equally across any and all other type of situations.
Well, chairs, member, and staff, the answer is yes. And you're correct in your recollection about what occurs. People's licenses are merely suspended, and it's for an indefinite period, and what is required is that they get an occupational license, which they get. What we're suggesting is that as conditions of probation, which are either at the county or the state level, a possible part of that sentence, they should be taking a mental and physical exam. They should pass a driver's course, which is safety and skills training, to make sure that they have the equipment and the skills to drive again, and that they should make restitution. I'm not talking about pain and suffering damages. I'm talking about basic restitution for the out-of-pocket expenses of the hurt person. And then finally, they should do some community service. They should do some work in the community for a good purpose as a condition of probation, to make some demonstration that they take it seriously, that they just did something horrid, and so that the victims and their families know that this just wasn't some situation where somebody got a ticket and sent in a check in an envelope and never even made a court appearance. Thank you.
Thanks. And the misdemeanor that somebody actually, the traffic violation has to do with the wreck. So for example, what you're talking about is somebody inadvertently runs a red light and runs over somebody. That would be caused. But if they get in some other kind of an accident and it's their license plate's expired, that's not what we're talking about.
That's right. And if you take a look at the provisions when you get down to the nuts and bolts, you'll see that various of the nine states have solved the question in different ways in terms of what is the scope of those violations that are going to trigger this. And we've got a collection of laws, I think, that we could, in 10 minutes, come up with most of them, such as running a stop sign, failing to yield to a bicyclist in a bike lane, running a pedestrian down in a crosswalk, making an illegal turn, making an unlawful pass. Those are the kinds of things that are the choices that people make, which are terrifically dangerous and cause horrible consequences, and when they do, these should be the subject of some further action. Yes, thank you.
Hey, thank you. Any further question? Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Thomas, what happens when both the pedestrian or the bicyclist and the motorist are negligent? Does it become similar to a comparative negligence analysis?
Well, Mr. Taylor and chairs and members, when you are in the civil law, we have what's called comparative negligence. In the state of Oregon, we have instances where sometimes both participants, the victim and the driver, let's say a pedestrian who's crossing against the light and a driver who's driving too fast, will both be subject to citations. Obviously, the dead person isn't going to get a citation, but the fact is that the driver who received a citation, even though the collision, like many collisions, it's something that is caused by multiple factors sometimes. It would be a discretionary call whether this would be something that would be instituted by the charging officer. But the fact is that if there was a violation for one of the qualifying traffic violations, that would subject the driver to a potential for being charged with either the misdemeanor or the felony.
One follow-up question. And would the defendant have the right to argue that the other party was negligent? Too?
Well, what they would be able to do, and one of the things that we're trying to put into this are specific criteria for coverage to make charging decisions easier. They would be in a position where they could argue in mitigation of what happened that the other person was negligent, but the question would be, did you violate one of the listed traffic violations? Did you disregard that traffic control signal? And did that cause the death of another road user? And then, if it did, they would be in a position where they would be subject to conviction of the misdemeanor if they had a driver's license. In mitigation, they could say, well, you know, not only did I run the traffic signal, but the person was crossing illegally, or the person didn't have on bright, reflective clothing. They could bring that in mitigation. But in terms of whether or not they had committed the elements of the offense, I don't think that it would be that much of a relevant consideration. If they committed a violation of the traffic law and it caused the death of somebody, then they would be subject to a potential prosecution.
Thank you.
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A brief statement, I suppose. Perhaps it's because of my recent conversion into a road biker, but the policy and legal questions I think this bill presents intrigue me, and I plan to engage with Representative Reed and anyone else who might be interested to help move this forward.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Ray, one other thing I want to follow up on. In the area of the misdemeanors, it sounds like your perspective is that it'd be a moving violation, but what if someone's driving without operator's license and no op? So they have really no right to be out driving on the road. Would you put that within that category?
Chairs and members and staff, I'd put that and urge that be within the felonies category, because these are folks who, if they know that they either don't qualify for or decided never to get a license, are a real danger, as Doug Perro told you. The rates for those folks are multiple times worse in terms of their likelihood to hurt us than for people who go through the requirements of actually obtaining and holding on to a driver's license.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Then you invite up your next. You want to invite up your next?
Mary O'Donnell and Dean Sigler.
And please go ahead and eat it in any order you'd like.
Okay. Chair Barker and Senator Przanski, my name is, thank you for the opportunity to be here to testify. This is the second time I've been here. I was here in 2007. My name is Mary O'Donnell, and I live in Aloha, Oregon. My husband, Tim O'Donnell,
died on Saturday, June 9th, 2007, doing something he really loved. Just about every Saturday, he joined members of the Portland Velo or long-distance ride in rural Washington County. Tim did absolutely nothing wrong. 40 miles into this ride, the car came upon them so fast that one of his riding partners, who was wearing a bright red jersey and bringing up the rear, told me afterwards, when I saw her, she was already next to us, straddling the center lane. I still am unable to actually say what happened next, so I ask you to read in the letter I have given you. It's just too painful for me to read that part. That's number three. The chaplain came to my house and told me that my husband had been killed and he was not coming home again. I tried to tell him that that must be some mistake. The man I loved 49 years could not be dead. Tim and I would have been married 49 years this coming April, but I will again celebrate my anniversary alone because a dangerous driver ran him down on his bike. The woman who ran Tim down paid her traffic tickets with her mother's credit card and no consequences for what she did. Time has passed. More victims have been killed by people who should not have been driving. Oregon needs to do more about dangerous drivers who have already demonstrated that they cannot safely operate motor vehicles. Some drivers have been suspended multiple times and continue to drive. It is inexcusable and unacceptable for the state to continue to allow them to flaunt the law and endanger everybody else who is using our roads, including our other motorists, bicyclists, and pedestrians. I have vowed since 2007 to make something positive come out of Tim's senseless death. Please support a vehicular homicide law for Oregon. Thank you very much for listening.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much, Mary, for coming down. We know it's very difficult, and appreciate you doing that.
I'd like to share this picture with you.
If you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes.
Thank you.
My name is Dean Sigler. I'm the grandfather of 18-year-old Jocelyn Lotka, and my daughter Anne, her mother, is here with us today also. Jocelyn was run down on January 4th, 2006, while lawfully crossing Southeast Salmon Street in a crosswalk as she carried groceries home from Fred Meyer's, a local store. Her brain was destroyed by the force of the collision. She was hit by a 3-ton F-350 pickup, and I'll talk about the particulars that are relevant in a minute. The family chose to take her off life support the following day, and she died that night. Jocelyn at the time was a Japanese language student at Portland State University. She played flute and baritone, tenor, alto, and soprano saxophones. She was highly talented. She was part of an award-winning high school jazz band that was extraordinary to hear. She was an artist and a judo competitor just shy of her black belt. This picture was taken after her final match. Jocelyn's loss was entirely preventable if the driver had not cut the corner. And that was because of tires and rims that impeded proper turns. In fact, the installation shop that put the tires on for him advised him that the tires rubbed on the inside frame of the car, of the vehicle. He was cutting the corner when he ran her down, could not make a proper right angle turn. However, the driver was not found to be driving recklessly or under the influence of any intoxicant. So police cited him for failing to stop for a pedestrian in a crosswalk and careless driving. He paid $704 in fines by mail. He never had to appear before a judge. When I was here 2 years ago appealing for the vulnerable users law that you were wise to pass. The three people who appeared before you, we averaged it out afterwards. It ended up being a $1,200 average fine for killing somebody on our state highways if you're using a car. If Oregon had a vehicular homicide law that applied to drivers who kill while violating a traffic law, then there would be real consequences for these avoidable tragedies. I believe that as the law stands now, drivers don't have sufficient consequences, and when they wrongfully cause serious injury or death to a vulnerable roadway user. I can understand how accidents do happen, but in a serious accident, the state of Oregon should take greater responsibility than exists now in the law in order to create real consequences for the tragic mistake. In Jocelyn's case, our family felt that her life was not given sufficient weight when the law allowed the person who caused her death to send a check in an envelope to court and never appear before a judge to acknowledge the seriousness of his conduct. Our family felt that this penalty was trivial compared to the loss he inflicted on our family in taking the life of a young woman full of talent and promise. Physically, mentally, emotionally, Jocelyn was everything that a family could wish in their children. The promise of her abilities, the warmth of her person, were denied their rightful chance to make the world a better place for her being there. Please take time to consider and pass a law that will protect people like Jocelyn. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Przanski. I'm sorry.
That's quite all right. Did either of you take any civil action against the individuals involved in this, filing a wrongful death suit or any other type of actions?
My daughter and her ex-husband did take this to civil action. That was on the advice of the district attorney, who felt there was nothing he could do at that time to further a criminal conviction.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. There was a civil action, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you. And as I mentioned before, Representative Reed has been working on this. I know he's contacting people in Arizona about the Arizona law. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you doing that. Ms. Myers?
Yeah, I asked Thomas if they looked in. Thomas, I don't want to see her.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I want to parrot our mutual concern that the decision to get behind the wheel of a car is a decision of grave import. And we do share a concern for vehicular safety for passengers, cyclists, pedestrians, and other drivers. And I would just also like to say that a lot of our members are cyclists and bicycle enthusiasts, and many of them commute to work, and so they have a mutual concern for traffic safety as well. What has not happened on this issue of vehicular homicide, is having everyone in the room at the same time talking. We've not had the District Attorneys Association, the defense lawyers, the proponents of this bill in a room, putting our heads together, talking this through. This issue did come up in 2009. The hearings were had on the House side. We did limit it then to aggravated driving while suspended, aggravated driving while revoked. I thought then that was a good calibration and a good response. Oregon does have a fair share of homicide laws. It does include DUII and other forms of reckless homicide and criminally negligent homicide. The proponents here are attempting to go into something more closer to strict liability. I think that the concern is this. what to do, and the comments were raised by Mr. Taylor, what to do when it's really the other person that's the causation of the accident. So you may have a suspended driver, for instance, who did not use a right-hand turn signal, for instance, and was turning right, but you have the other driver, intoxicated, going at excessive rate of speed, comes in and T-bones him. But if that suspended driver had not been suspended, that suspended driver would be the victim of that accident. But if that suspended driver then is suspended, then they become the defendant of a felony. So I think that that's what we need to look at. How do you really calibrate the proximate cause of the accident? And is it really just the suspension? Is it really just the failure to signal and some violation of some traffic law? What do you do really if it's the other driver who is more reckless and causes the accident? How do we handle that? So I just simply say to the committee, we started to look at these issues in 2009. We came back to a narrow focus. The proponents still feel there's a lack of sufficient calibration here, and I just suggest that really what would be advantageous is to get the district attorneys in at the table and start working some of these issues through.
Okay, thank you. And I know Representative Reed and myself have talked to other parties, and we expect this to actually not be completed until the 2011 session, and in the interim we'll hopefully get work groups together and get some of these questions answered
right. And
resolved. And I do appreciate the Bicycle Alliance's position on, even if it's a felony, that they're not looking for prison time. They're looking for something less than that, and I think they're being very considerate, or taking great consideration in what they're asking for. But there are other questions that need to be answered, and so we'll try to get it all resolved, and so we have a workable, viable bill for the 2011 session.
Great.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So for the Senate, I believe we've completed all of our work, and just want to make sure the council.
Mm-hmm.
All right. With that, the Senate's going to go ahead and adjourn, allowing the House to continue its portion going into public hearings on some of the bills, I guess, that are scheduled for the February session. So unless there's anything else for the Senate, the Senate Interim Committee for Judiciary is concluded for today.
Close the vehicular homicide hearing and open a public hearing. We're going to go out of order. We're going to go to House Bill 3634. Come on up and
thank you, testify
anywhere you'd like.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm with Crime Victims United of Oregon, and I'm here to testify and give information to you regarding House Bill 3634. As you know, crime victims' rights in Oregon have a long history dating back to the 1980s, and we have very good crime victims' rights in Oregon. However, the crime victims' rights we have take care of everything from the time that the crime happens through the end of the trial, and then things stop. We do have a slight patchwork pattern of some rights, but basically everything that's post-trial that happens in six major areas of appeals, habeas corpus, post-conviction relief, PSRB, both adult and juvenile, and parole board, there really aren't crime victims' rights plugged in, and we need to have those rights, from notifications of these hearings and proceedings to the right to appear to, in some cases, the right to speak to, in other cases, the right to be protected, such as in a parole board hearing or a PSRB hearing. So this bill basically will codify those rights into Oregon statutes to make sure that victims are protected from the time of the time the crime happens through the very end of all proceedings that they have to go through. And I brought two gentlemen with me here today that will expound upon this. One is Doug Bloof, who's a professor at Lewis and Clark Law School and was the founder of NCVLI, a National Crime Victims Law Institute. Doug's been working on writing the bill. And also Doug Harkleroad, who is the former elected district attorney of Lane County. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to these gentlemen. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I think you all know that I was a DA for a long time, and Doug Bloof is going to talk about the specifics of this bill. I just want to make a couple of points here.
And please say your name for the...
Oh, I'm sorry, okay. Chair Barker. Doug Harkleroad. I'm a lawyer in private practice now. I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, so thank you. When I started as district attorney in 1985, crime victims had no rights. That's right, crime victims had absolutely no rights. That's not to say DAs and police officers didn't do good work with those people, but they had no rights. We first got our rights in victims' rights in 1987, and it was by a vote of the people, not by legislation. It was by a vote of the people. And then, in 1999, we got constitutional rights. Article 1, Section 42 and 43 are those constitutional rights, and that was once again by a vote of the people. The legislature has weighed in several times, and we now have some enforceable rights, thanks to the last legislative session, and you folks were instrumental in that. Victims' rights are, by the way, one of the most, just a side note here, but one of the best things I ever did as district attorney was the second day I was in office, I started a victim services program. There was a little bit of money from the state to hire a coordinator, and then you hired a bunch of, then you recruited a bunch of volunteers. And it's been a wonderful program, not just in Lane County DA's office, but all around the state these days, as you folks well know. So, the Attorney General, and I suspect there's an updated version of this, but last night when I was looking in my files, I have the Hardy Miles version, Legal Rights for Crime Victims in Oregon. And when you read these pamphlets, and there are a number of them, and DA's offices have them, and you read all these wonderful rights, and then you realize that there is a gap, because it's almost all, up to the time of conviction. There are a few scattered rights, as Steve indicated, after that, but we don't have a comprehensive set of rights for the appellate process, and we should do that for victims. The last thing I would say before Doug walks you through the bill is that we spend hundreds of millions of dollars on defendants. Now, there's a whole variety of reasons for doing that. One of the principal ones is to protect all of us from offenders. But we also spend lots of money on them to rehabilitate them, which I'm all in favor of, and I wish we could do more in the reentry area in these tough times. But when you compare the amount of money we spend on offenders to the amount of money on victims, it pales in comparison. I've never calculated that, but right now, if somebody is burglarized, we can't even take care of the damages in the burglary. If they're victimized with a person crime, we do have a fund for that. Yeah. So we do very little in terms of the economics for victims as compared to offenders. And with that, I turn it over to Doug to walk you through the bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair Barker, honorable members of the committee. Steve Dole had contacted me in the fall and asked me to
identify yourself.
Oh yeah, I apologize. My name is Doug Ballouf. I'm a law professor at Lewis and Clark College and a national expert on crime victim law. Steve Dole had called me in the fall and asked me to take a stab at drafting legislation that would extend crime victims' rights that already exist in the criminal trial system into both the post-trial criminal system and into other agencies' jurisdictions that were involved with victims, the parole board, the PSRB, for example. And I took a stab at that. And that's, we reviewed it with legislative counsel, we reviewed it with Doug Harkleroad, some other victim experts in the state, and that's the bill you have before you. I will state quite candidly that today is the first opportunity I've had to speak with members of these agencies, and we intend on speaking with each other in the very near future in order to iron out any issues they may have with the bill. That opportunity has not taken place for either of us, frankly, largely due to my schedule and the fact that I was out of the state until the day before yesterday. So essentially what our goal is here is it's to take victims' rights that are broadly and generally accepted in the criminal process and spread those out to other places where crime victims are involved. Of course, there are issues that have arisen in my conversations with these folks that do need addressing, and that we're open to working with them on in order to resolve them in the hopes that we can bring a complete single amended bill back that has very little pushback, as I think the term is in politics. So that's where we are in the process. With that understanding, I'm happy to answer any specific questions about the bill, as long as you know that there are probably some issues you'll ask me about that I haven't had an opportunity to work through with the agencies. So that's where we are.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Barton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question really for anyone. I'm trying to understand what this bill would mean in practice. And for example, let's just take a habeas proceeding.
Sure.
This bill is enacted. How is the procedure different? What does this bill grant the victims that they don't already have in practice?
Well, that the hearing's going on at all. Notice that the hearing's going on at all, for one
thing. In application, you have to forgive me. I never clerked at appellate court. I've never really done habeas work. Is notice not given right now?
Right. And victims' rights are just now evolving into the appellate system and post-conviction system. So notice is typically not given. The appellate system operates in its own independent way, and victims will usually find out about this, if they're lucky, if a trial-level DA, when they're notified by the Attorney General's office that the result of an appeal has happened and there's a result. But quite frankly, trial DAs are mighty busy, and they might not even provide the notice of the result, just given the burdens they have and the fact that they're not commanded to do so. So really what this does is it allows in appeal, post-conviction, and habeas, these sections, for the victim to be aware these proceedings are going on. It allows them to attend those. Now, there's nothing in law preventing them from attending them in the first place, which may be one of the bases of your question, but this makes clear that they may attend. And so they have notice, and then they're informed that they can attend, because victims are lay people. They're not attorneys. They don't know necessarily what they can and can't participate in. So it provides them a right to do that. So it's not revolutionary in the sense that it's not upsetting. These post-conviction habeas appeal things aren't upsetting any apple carts or the functionings of how things work terribly. But they do extend these considerations and accommodations beyond the trial stage.
Mr. Chairman, ask a follow-up question?
Yes, you can.
One section, just one line specifically, it's on page 3 of the bill, mm-hmm. It's line 4, section. So it would be section 7D, mm-hmm. The right to timely disposition of the petition, i.e. the victim has the right to timely disposition. I'm assuming post-conviction relief, that right currently does not exist, for example, to the petitioner. My concern, it just occurs to me that the courts, particularly the Supreme Court, I'm told, is burdened with a very, very large number. An extraordinary percentage of their docket is actually often post-conviction petitions of one form or another that have an extremely low success rate. And I'm kind of curious if we grant a right to timely disposition, if that would not undermine their ability to function.
Are we talking about the U.S. Supreme Court or the Oregon Supreme Court?
State Supreme Court.
I don't think it'll undermine their ability to function. My understanding is that the Chief Justice has been very aggressive in informing the courts that he believes very strongly in defendants' speedy trial rights, mm-hmm. and that he doesn't want to see cases go sideways, essentially. This is what I hear. He has not told me this personally. So I think this is in accord with that assessment. It will always be the case. It will always be the case that defendants' due process rights trump a victim's right to some sort of speedy disposition. The central issue is when things drag on inexorably as they can beyond the time necessary for resolution, or even beyond the time necessary for administrative resolution or court resolution of a particular matter, for whatever reason. This provides the opportunity for the victim to raise their hand and say, this has been going on an awfully long time, and I want to jog you. I want to let you know it's been going on a long time. In practice, these kinds of laws around the country, how they have played out is they have simply given the opportunity to inform the court that things are going slowly. They do not result in dismissal or any kind of disruption in the case in that fashion.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question really just from curiosity.
Sure.
I see in Section 10, at the bottom of page 5, talking about PSRB.
What line are you on?
I'm at the very bottom of page 5, subsection 3 of section 10.
All right. 41.
And this is talking about PSRB patients. And there's a provision there that talks about notice to the community.
Yeah,
and that's something that isn't found in the rest of the bill for other types of
And I've talked to Bob Jundep, and okay. I've talked to Mary Claire from the PSRB, and I think we will work through those issues.
Okay.
Well, thank you for bringing it to my attention.
Sure.
Mr. Joel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, if I could back to Representative Barton's first question about these rights just for a moment. What we did is when we took these six different areas, we tried to plug in the existing rights that were already given to victims where necessary. And I think that I've gotten a tremendous increase in calls in the last number of years, probably about the last 3 years, from victims stating, gee, a PCR happened and I didn't know about it, or I wasn't informed from the parole board, or there's an appeal that happened. Why don't I know these things? Why has everything seemed to stop for me? And I think the two most notable cases we had were the Gilmore case in the parole board, if you all recall. Tiffany Edens was the victim in that case, and the other one was the Groger case with the PSRB, where we had a complete breakdown when it came to notification, etc. So these are the cases. These are just two, but this is something that it has really brought light to me that we have this gaping hole in within crime victims' rights. And also, if I could say this, I think Doug Bluth alluded to it, but we have comments from the AG's office, and we are going to have a meeting tomorrow with Legislative Counsel Josh Nasby at 1 o'clock to go through the AG's comments and some other comments that Josh had on the bill as he drafted it. So this is a work in progress. I want to reiterate that.
Hey, and I just also like to say that I know you could give victims the information, but if you don't do a follow-up, people going through a trauma of all that, they don't hear it. It's kind of like going to the doctor and they say cancer, and that's about the last thing you hear them say.
you don't know, then, you know, unless somebody's there with you to listen to what the doctor has to tell you, you don't know.
I can understand
what happened. So anyway, thank you. I appreciate your efforts on this.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we have other people would like to speak. Brunson James, Bob Junedep, and Mary Claire Buckley, please. And please go ahead in any order. Remember to identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. As you may know, the Psychiatric Security Review Board's statutory mandate is to protect the public through the ongoing review of the progress of its clients and a determination of their appropriate placement, be that in the state hospital, in the community on conditional release, or ultimate discharge. The board performs that function through a hearings process. The enabling statutes set out the time frames within which each type of hearing must be conducted by the board, and it is this hearings process that is affected by House Bill 3634. From the outset, I want to assure this committee that the board recognizes the critical role of victims in this process and always has. Notice to those victims who request a desire to receive it has been a statutory requirement and a standard practice of the board since its inception more than 30 years ago. That notice is sent routinely 3 to 3.5 weeks in advance of the hearing currently. If that does not provide the victim with enough time, or the victim has a conflict with the date that has been set by the board always reschedules the hearing to accommodate a victim. The board affords the victims rights to be heard in person, by telephone, or in writing. The board currently affords a meaningful role in its process and certainly considers their input and position when making its decisions. Thus, the board was unclear as to the need for this legislation, at least with regards to the board. The board, as you heard, was not involved in the drafting of this legislation. In fact, we just learned of this on Monday afternoon. But after review, the board thought it was important that this that I share with this committee some of the initial concerns that were raised in reading the bill as presently written. These include the vagueness of some of the language and the broadness of other provisions, the access to what has been to this point confidential protected information contained in the board's exhibit file, which I think warrants greater discussion regarding its potential ramifications. The workload issues that these additional mandates would implicate that could not possibly be absorbed by the current staffing that I have. And the need to enroll in the VINE system to meet the immediate notification of escape provision that's currently contained in this proposal, and the fiscal impact associated with at least those last two concerns. And finally, the board has concerned about the proposed effective date, as it could not or does not have the ability, I believe, at this point to comply with all of these provisions by the end of next month. However, in conversations prior to this hearing, you know, I've heard the willingness of the proponents, and the board is more than willing to work with the proponents and other stakeholders to see what we can do to resolve these concerns. Thank you.
And you heard that they're meeting Friday. If you want to contact Josh and Asby, and maybe
I will do so.
I think they said tomorrow at 1.
Is it tomorrow at 1? I thought it was Friday.
Isn't that one?
Maybe it's tomorrow.
Sorry. It's tomorrow.
Okay,
tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Ms. Buckley, so how often do the residents of the under the PSRB have a hearing?
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, under the current statute, when an individual is placed under the board has to have a hearing within 90 days of their initial placement. Thereafter, a patient has the right to request a hearing every 6 months, and the board has 60 days within which to set it after receiving that request. And if the board does not receive a patient request, the board is required by law to hold a hearing every 2 years to check on the individual status. For those on conditional release, we have to have a hearing every 5 years. And if an individual is revoked from conditional release, we must have a hearing within 20 days of their return to the state hospital.
Follow-up. What proportion of the folks in PSRB require hearings every 6 months?
Chair Bakker, Representative Tomei, I would say that that's a relatively small percentage, thankfully, for, you know, given the limited number of opportunities we have to provide those. So,
follow-up?
Follow-up,
I remember in one meeting that we had, there was a father of a victim, and apparently the PSRB patient had requested hearings every 6 months, and he had problems attending those hearings every 6 months. How is that taken care of?
Chair Bakker, Representative Tomei, if the victim were to, contact us, we would send the letter, and then when we hear from them, if as I said, if the date, didn't work for them, then we would accommodate that and set a date that was mutually acceptable, to the victim or convenient to the victim. At some point that we do have to provide that under the law, so if they just didn't want to come every 6 months, that would be problematic. But if it's with regard to a specific setting of a specific date for the required hearing, we would accommodate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Stinker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real briefly, it seems to me from your testimony that the victims' rights under the PSRB system at this stage of the game is pretty much victim generated. It's not so proactive on the part of the PSRB, but more proactive if it's like initiated by the victim and then you respond.
Chair Bakker, Representative Stiegler, no. In fact,
do you initiate the contact?
We initiate the contact. How it works now is that the court has the responsibility of determining at the time of the disposition of the case whether, in fact, that victim wants to be notified in the future of all future hearings. Once we receive that information, it goes into our database, and we proactively send notices in advance of every hearing, and then if they contact us and want to to participate in that hearing, then we set the date, as I said, that can meet their needs.
Follow-up? And I take it from your testimony that you're willing to work with the group to refine the process or expand it, as your concerns are primarily related to any fiscal implications it might have on the PSRB.
Chair Bakker, Representative Stiegler, absolutely.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Chair Bakker, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon, and I come to you to talk just about those provisions that have to do with the PSRB hearing process. We got a hold of a copy of the bill yesterday, so did a quick review, and we just have some concerns we want to bring to you, and we've already brought to the proponents of the bill, and we are very willing to sit down and talk about those. Just to highlight, though, the one provision, and I'd like to thank Representative Garrett for asking the question. There is a provision in the bill that sets community notice standards for folks under the PSRB that don't exist anywhere else in the legislation for other groups. And our concern, of course, is that this particular group of people not be singled out for discriminatory treatment in the way that Oregon chooses to help victims in terms of participating in matters that have come out of the criminal courts. The second area has to do with confidentiality of medical and psychiatric records. It's important to remember that when a person is placed under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, they have not been convicted per se. They have been found to have been unable to control their behavior or conform their behavior to the law because of a mental disorder, and they're sent to the hospital for mental health treatment. And the purpose of doing so is to give them the treatment, hopefully rehabilitate them, either cure or mitigate their mental disorder, and to return them safely to society. So they're there for treatment. They generate psychiatric treatment records, and those are very confidential is, I guess, the best word I could use. Psychiatric records are considered to be especially confidential for people, and we need to make sure that those records are not spread across communities, because that will just further impede their ability to get the treatment that they need and return to society. And the last area has to do with just the definitions of certain terms. There's some vagueness in there. We want to work with Mr. Ballouf and other advocates to make sure that those terms are as clear as possible, and so they're consistently applied again across the victims' rights statutes.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bronson James. I'm Chief Deputy Defender for Oregon's Office of Public Defense Services. As the committee, I'm sure, is aware, but I'll remind the committee for the record, the Office of Public Defense Services is statutorily tasked with the representation, first with the coordination of indigent defense contracts throughout the state, and then we localize the representation of defendants on appeal. The appellate division processes approximately 2,200 criminal appeals each year. We are also the agency that is statutorily mandated for the representation of all inmates in matters concerning the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I wish I had for you today our agency's position on this bill, but unfortunately the bill came to my attention less than 48 hours ago. So I can tell you that it is something that we would very much like the opportunity to carefully craft an agency position on, particularly since it seems to touch on all aspects of the work that we do, in that it appears to make procedural changes across the board, both to appeals, to post-conviction proceedings, and to parole proceedings as well. And all of those changes, some of which we're uncertain of what the intent of the bill is. As you've heard reference, language that we're just simply uncertain of, for instance, what does it mean to have a meaningful role? And that type of language appears throughout the bill, yet is undefined. So for a number of these reasons, we would appreciate the opportunity to work sort of slowly and carefully and methodically through this bill, and are happy to do so with any of the proponents of the bill. But we're just, there's simply not enough, I did not have enough time between a notice of this bill and given the scope of what it does to make what I was concerned might be a snap judgment. So, and if the committee has any questions, particularly about several portions of the bill that relate to appeals, post-conviction proceedings, parole, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. James, thank you for volunteering that, because you knew it was coming, I suppose.
Yes.
It's always a pleasure to have you and your expertise in front of the committee. I'm actually going to ask you, take you to the same provision I did, Mr. Maloof, which is on page 3.
Mm-hmm.
It is section 5. It's line 4 of page 3, section 5, subsection D. Do you see anything, do you see that one sentence of having any practical implications?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, let me preface by saying any comments I'm about to make, I'm not advocating any position of the Office of Public Defense Services. I'll answer your question as best as I can on my legal interpretation.
Can you give us off the cuff, too?
Can you give us the location again? I'm not finding where you are.
Sorry, page 3, line 4.
Thanks.
Yeah.
First of all, it's important to note that post-conviction proceedings actually take place in circuit court. They're not to the appeals court, although they can be appealed to the appeals court. They begin in circuit court, and they're a proceeding that's almost entirely conducted by affidavit. So it's a paper proceeding. You indicated earlier that they compose a significant portion of circuit court dockets throughout the state. They do. They can take a long time. The reason that they can take a long time is because the way post-conviction has developed historically in Oregon is the principal mechanism for litigating kind of the could-haves, should-have, would-haves of trial. So evidence that should have been discovered but wasn't, testimony, witnesses that should have been called but were not, etc.
It's the principal avenue for litigating claims of actual innocence, DNA evidence, that sort of thing. So they take a long time to develop because there's a lot of investigation that goes into them, particularly with complex felonies. Circuit courts, appeals courts, particularly Oregon's appellate courts, are very busy. I think all parties, defendants included, would love statutory provisions that allowed things to move quicker. But you know, the system is what the system is right now. The other comment that I would add to you, in my response to you, is, and I guess I'm sensitive to this coming from the defense side, where we're often litigating the nature of individual rights, which is what this bill seems to purport. And I can tell you from my experience that an individual right that offers no remedy for a violation of that right is ephemeral, and it largely exists on paper only. My question about the statute as it is written is it provides a right to the timely disposition of the petition, but I don't see anything about what the denial of that timely disposition would result in, whether that right is enforceable in some manner, that sort of thing. So that would be the questions that I would flow out of that particular provision.
Mr. Chairman, ask a follow-up.
Yes, you can.
I'm sorry to take so much time this morning. I didn't even drink coffee. Can you tell what in your, again, off-the-cuff opinion, what do you, to the extent that line, same line now, page 3, line 4, let's pretend that were enacted into law. Could you foresee, how, if at all, would that affect the practice of Oregon, death penalty in Oregon?
Let me roll it back. Let me say, just because this applies to post-conviction proceedings.
True.
Based upon any conviction.
Correct.
And again, what I want to be very clear, sorry, skip the formality here, Chairman Barker, Representative Barker.
I threw a big one on you. I'm sorry, James.
I haven't had time to consult with Professor Blue from the proponents here, so I don't know what their intent is, and I don't mean to be reading in something that may not be there, so take it with a grain of salt. There are aspects of the bill that I think, if pushed, seem to implicate a new litigant in a proceeding. Essentially an extra chair at the table. What had been the state and a defendant, or in the case of the parole board, which is not really an adversarial proceeding at all, but is simply a fact-finding, more of an inquest. It seems to put another chair there and inject an individual who has got certain procedural rights, and one would assume that they want these procedural rights to come with some enforcement capability, and therefore inject another proponent in this litigation. I don't know how that would play out. All I can tell you from personal experience, both in civil and criminal law, is, you know, the more people you add into the room, the sort of longer things take, and the more complicated they get. Now, I have absolutely no idea if that's their intent, is to really push it into a pure litigant stance or not. The bill as written, I think, has those implications. Another, I think, reason to work it out in a slow, methodical manner.
Thank you for your patience this morning, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you. Ms. Byard?
This morning, do you know that PAPM could have the same effect?
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I also am speaking off the cuff and not on behalf of the association. We just found out about the bill on Monday, so we haven't really been able to go over it with a fine-tooth comb. I would simply like to point out one provision that's been referenced already but not emphasized, perhaps, and that's the consistent right that's put in all of these different segmented proceedings of the right to have unfettered access to all information without limitation of how the victim might subsequently use that information. And so it simply provides the right of the victim to all information at issue in the proceedings. Now, if you're talking about the appellate proceedings, I don't think that's very much of consequence. It's the appellate record. If you're talking about post-conviction relief, generally those are exhibits that are entered into public record. Again, I don't think that's any big thing. But if you talk about the hearings before the agencies, the Psychiatric Security Review Board and the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, those have been confidential records and files. And so if you look at the provision as it relates to the proceedings in front of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, it would be Section 14 on page 9, starting at 25, it gives the victim, personally or by counsel, and the district attorney shall be given access to the information that the board will rely upon, including correction files, security files, psychological records, and the board's entire file. So this has consequence for the Department of Corrections. It has a lot of consequences for the agencies. And I would just point out that when an inmate's in prison, they are typically forced to go through evaluations, or, you know, sometimes they elect to. But it's one thing for the offender to know that the results of those evaluations and psychological consultations will be made known to the board. But it's another thing for that inmate to know that it also, that the victim will have full access to it. A lot of times the victims and the defendants know each other. They come from very complicated familial relationships. There may be disclosures that won't be made now as a result of knowing that the victim ultimately might have access to the report. So all I'm saying is there's a lot of consequences down the road here, and I do think that it would be important in these work groups not just to perhaps pierce out language, but also to have those entities whose files and records are at issue to come to the table also, so that we can really understand the full consequences of all this.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We close the public hearing on House Bill 3634.
Yeah. My non-legal
you're
line
up,
there.
Up here.
Yeah.
And open a...
I mean, I got to go up and down and around, right?
Public hearing on House Bill 3601. And call Representative Stigler.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Judy Stigler. I am the state representative for House District 54, City of Bend, and down into Deschutes River Woods. I'm here today introducing a bill that the concept came to me through local law enforcement in and around my community, and been working over the last few months to try to come up with a way to address some of the issues that were raised. Specifically, House Bill 3601 has to do with the suspension hearing process after a DUI arrest, when somebody has either exceeded the limit or has refused to blow and their license is suspended as a result of the implied consent laws. And what the issue that came to me was the cost to local police agencies for the administrative hearing process that occurs. And so what I did over the last few months was work with various folks in the Department of Justice as well as legislative counsel here to try to craft something that would help bring down the cost of these hearings to both the local police agencies, that's the city police, sheriff, state police, as well as to the state in the Department of Administrative Hearings, the costs that they incur. What House Bill 3601 does is basically three things. It makes those hearings, those suspension hearings upon request, let me back up a little bit. Upon a request for a hearing, those hearings would be held either telephonically or by some other electronic means. So in other words, we wouldn't have to do the jockeying around, the traveling around the state. People wouldn't have to travel from point A to point B to attend these hearings. They would be conducted telephonically or by some other electronic means. Secondly, there would be a fee assessed for the process. If you want to appeal your suspension, you would have to pay a fee. But there is a provision. We worked this through. I asked legislative counsel for their opinion regarding the potential problems with this, and we have provided an indigency provision so that the fee can be waived in whole or in part based upon certain indigency standards that are currently used in other aspects of the Department of Motor Vehicles. And then finally, we wanted to clarify, because one of the other presenting problems that was brought to my attention was the fact that the current statute reads, and this is, you'll see it on page 3 of the proposed bill, section 2, it's down on line 36 and 37, we clarified that the police officer that would appear at these suspension hearings can be a police officer involved in the investigation of the offense. Previously, a statute read the officer signing the citation. That officer isn't necessarily the way, and those of you who have worked out in the field understand that necessarily the officer that signs the citation isn't always the officer who stopped and conducted the field sobriety tests and was the person who, or the officer observing the activity, the driving activity directly. So we want to make it clear that it wasn't, the responsible officer wasn't necessarily just the officer signing on the citation. I have worked with the chiefs, the Sheriff's Association, as well as the State Police Association, and with their representatives to make sure that they didn't have any issues with this process, this change in process, and in fact, they're, to my knowledge, very supportive of it. I've been trying to gather some facts and figures as to potential cost savings, and some other folks might have some other information that I haven't yet been privy to. I know my local police department, the Bend City Police Department, estimated they would save somewhere between $7,000 and $11,000, and it may not sound like much, but you multiply that times all the different city police departments there are potentially in this state. And I did receive some figures from the Office of Administrative Hearings. They estimate that they currently, just on the motor pool costs, the hotel and per diem for the administrative law judges, and the travel time for administrative law judges, currently spend approximately, or just shy of $160,000 a year. So that's a fairly significant savings in that department as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you for bringing the bill, Representative Stigler. And it was nice to chat with you briefly about it last night. An idea, and you don't have to respond to the idea, but I really laud the effort to think about how we can do essential functions of government with fewer dollar per interaction, right? I mean, that's a really valuable pursuit. And we might even consider including within the bill, and maybe it could be done in implementation, or maybe it's in the bill, just getting an estimate of that money that's saved from the entities that are saving it, not to pass the bill, but to evaluate it going forward.
Gotcha.
To track that money and add it up. So every, you know, it's like, so the passage of the, you know, Representative Stigler, you know, memorial bill, you know, every year saved, you know, $157,000 for
memorial bill.
I understand.
Would bode ill
for the taxpayers and the citizens of Oregon. So that's my one idea. Start tracking where we're finding ways to save money, that we measure that and communicate it.
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, I think that's a great idea. And of course, my intent in trying to gather some information, and you know, granted, it's only been in the last, I'd say probably a couple of months, that we've been sort of working on moving forward on this. Once it appeared that there was a viable vehicle to try to instill some cost savings in the process. And I know that, like I said, folks in the different associations have been working on trying to gather some of those figures, but I think as sort of the benchmark from where you go from there, I think that's a great idea.
Thanks.
Thank you. Is that it? Kevin Campbell, John Powell, and Gail Meyer.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'm here in support of House Bill 3601. I want to begin by thanking Representative Stigler for working with our chiefs in Central Oregon and throughout the state for the bill. There is cost savings that we're currently evaluating in cities throughout the state. I thought probably the best illustration might be to kind of draw a light on this might be the challenge that the city of Ontario has, because their officers for these administrative hearings have to travel to Baker City. So we have officers in cars traveling on the highway for administrative hearings, and the idea of being able to do that by telephone just makes great sense. And I'm starting to get the data in now from chiefs throughout the states who have various challenges in terms of traveling distance and overtime commitments. And I guess their message is they would love to have their officers spending their overtime hours more and more in the enforcement of DUI than in the administrative hearings process of getting to and from and the costs associated with that. So this is a smart bill. We really appreciate the effort, and we support it fully. And I'll be brief this morning so I can let everybody else talk. But thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Powell, representing Oregon's 36 sheriffs. Somebody take Mr. Campbell aside and tell him what brief really means. Anyway, we support this bill.
He says that at every hearing. No matter how long I speak.
We support this bill for the reasons that Mr. Campbell articulated over and over, and we appreciate the efforts being made. I would question, however, that the record keeping that Representative Smith raised might be problematic in terms of trying to document how much time was saved. Most of these savings will be in travel, which does accrue to overtime in many cases. But then they would have to keep track somehow of that, and that might be problematic. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I'm here to tell you we don't oppose this bill. I really just wanted to get up and say that.
I still think it's a good bill.
I threw it out to my members. They thought they could work with it. There's exigencies and cost savings for them as well. Yep. So, you know, on balance, I think this is something they can definitely work with. So.
Representative Smith.
And speaking of the record, and thanks, Mr. Powell, wouldn't suggest timesheets. Might suggest an estimate. And we can argue about it later.
No, that's fine.
Okay. Any further questions from anybody? Thank you very much, ma'am.
And Mr. Chair, could I just add, I wanted to give Ms. Myers an opportunity to be able to say that.
Thank you.
It's been a long day.
Yeah.
Okay. We're waiting for a representative on one of the bills, so we're going to move on to LC 155, which is the concept that authorizes the Department of State Police to adopt rules for predatory sex offender notice statutes and sex offender reporting and registration statutes. So I have Vi Beatty.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Vi Beatty. I'm the manager of the Oregon State Sex Offender Registry with the state, Oregon State Police. We're asking for rulemaking authority regarding sex offender registration statutes so that we can clarify and unify the state on what it means to move into the state, what a residency means, or what a residence means, what it means to change your address. There is some written testimony attached to your legislative concept that outlines pretty much what I'm covering. So I'm just going to stop there and ask you if you have any questions that I can answer.
Are there any questions from the committee? This concept's trying to just catch up with things and allow the state police the authority to set some of these regulations themselves. So we don't have to create a new law to say, here's how you register a sex offender, and then when they find a flaw, we have to wait 2 years and come back and say, no, here's how you... That way they can do it on a continual basis as needed to keep the information and keep the public safe. Any, no questions? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Is that going to be the same as the committee bill?
This is the committee bill.
Okay.
Can I
Thank you.
Thank you. We can have coffee.
Close the hearing on LC 155 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3630. The Representative Matthews is going to be here. He's not here. Mr. Snyder, do you want to come up and jump into the pool here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. And House Bill 3630 is a bill on which we don't yet have a position, but we do have a high interest. The bill would allow, as I understand it, a county to provide for, in the event of an emergency release, a forced release of prisoners from the county jail. Forced release basically means the building is overcrowded. And because of that reason, people have to be pushed out someplace. In that circumstance, the bill, as I understand it, would allow for some supervision of the people who are released under those conditions. And it addresses an issue that I think should be addressed. The reason why we don't yet have a position is because there were some issues that were raised by other folks involving a previous draft. And we're hopeful that those issues will have been addressed by the latest version, but we're not sure that's been the case yet, and we were asked to wait until we knew one way or the other whether that was going to happen.
And we have Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Snyder, are you going to think you can live above the line 22? Is that normal to give immunity? Ms. Myers is going to speak on that one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, can I?
Yeah, please.
The immunity, that provision actually is already in current law. They just brought it from, if you look on page 2, lines 5. They just moved it forward. So that immunity provision is already there. It's already there. It's not written exactly the same.
Okay, thank you.
And this bill, Representative Matthews isn't here, but this bill comes out of Multnomah County, has asked for this because they sometimes have to make releases. I don't know if you saw the film a few years ago when the gate was going up and the people were scurrying under the fence to get out early. And Multnomah County would like to be able to supervise those people so that they don't run right back out and start committing more crimes, and they have a little more control over it. And again, it's the idea of public safety they're working on there. And it authorizes the county to do it, doesn't require it, as I understand. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've had some conversations with Representative Matthews and know less about the bill than he obviously and less than the county does. But my other understanding was it'd be valuable. In this part, I'm a little, I don't understand all of the texture of it, but there's also an issue of sort of prioritization, so we make sure that as we do our supervised release, we're doing it with, we have a greater degree to make sure we're doing it with, do it smartly, so we're not having lower supervision for more dangerous people on rather more supervision for people who are more dangerous.
Representative Wisnett, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Matthews is not here, but I don't understand it. I hope we're just not making state law for Multnomah County here, and because I guess you're saying it's May, the counties may do it. They're not going to do it. And I think we'll have to look at, is it easier, more cost effective to have them in prison, or are you going to have to supervise, and that could be more costly than?
It's much cheaper to have them out, to supervise them on the street in Multnomah County. And this is, Multnomah County runs up against the overcrowding situation. Yeah, they have to dump people out. And so they just.
Yeah, we do.
They want to be able to have some control. I've talked to Philip Kennedy Wong, has been involved in this from some time, and he was working with Representative Matthews on that. But they're concerned that otherwise you release them and tell them come back sometime later, and then you don't hear from them again. This way they'll be tracking them and hopefully keeping them out of trouble.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
But we're doing that now. We have a plan. So this is just saying you have to write the plan down, or you have to prioritize, or how? I don't understand what we're really doing here.
I think we're authorizing the counties to be able to do that.
To do more supervision.
They don't believe they have the authority to do that now.
To release them now.
Yeah, to release them with supervision.
With supervision.
Okay.
With conditions.
Exactly. I'll try to make my point a little better, and Representative Barton, who's been involved in the bill, can probably do a better job than I. But right now they're left with sort of a Hobson's choice of saying we're either going to release this person or keep them in. Okay, and they make a determination, well, this person really isn't ready to be released, so we're going to keep them in. But that might then make them release somebody else who's even worse to release, right? And so they have that sort of bad choice. Whereas if we give them a little bit more discretion and to have a greater degree, ambit of their authority, they could decide, you know what, we'd rather keep this person in than this person in. So we'll, and even though this person shouldn't be let out scot-free, we'll let them out rather than them and supervise them because they could work for supervision. They could live well in the community with supervision, right? Better than this person. Does that make a little more sense? And right now they don't have fully that authority, and this would give it to them. So I understand it. Representative Barton might want to add.
I'll say.
Yeah, my understanding is that currently jail facilities have a matrix of when they release people and what severity of crime on these pretrial releases, but what all they can do is cite them then to appear at their next court proceeding. I mean, that's about the only control they have over what happens once they walk out the door. So I think this is an effort to try to have a little bit more sort of vigor to what happens when they release them in that under those circumstances.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think Representative Stigler hit it right on the head. The focus of attention of this legislation, as I understand it, is pretrial.
Right.
It's not convicted offenders.
That's
it's
correct.
Pretrial defendants.
Yeah.
And there is a gap there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Snyder.
Where does it say that?
Well, that's what
the
stuff up before first.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Snyder. We won't close the hearing yet because we're trying to reach Representative Matthews.
Are we going to wait till 11?
No.
He's not available till 11.
Well,
sorry, Representative.
We're trying to contact him right now. We'll know in a few minutes, but we will not wait till 11.
We are very ahead of schedule.
Mr. Representative Lim, please.
I have an important guest from Korea. May I introduce?
Please,
you?
Come on up to the podium, please.
Okay.
Adjourn this public hearing.
Now,
recess it.
Recess the public hearing on
3630.
Thank you.
Okay.
Please. Hello.
Mr. Chair and the members of the committee and then guests. And I appreciate it. Mr. Lee, standing beside me, is the national congressman from Korea. Mm-hmm. He is visiting this Capitol building to celebrate Korean American Day. And on the rotunda, 11 o'clock today, he will be the keynote speaker. As a matter of fact, he is the congressman from my hometown, Yeosu, Korea.
Ah.
And so we are honored having him. And thank you very much for the brief moment I could introduce Mr. Lee, the Honorable Congressman Lee. Thank you very much.
Welcome to Oregon, Mr. Lee. We appreciate you taking the time to come. Thank you, Representative Lim, for bringing this guest to us.
Chair, can I have a small request to you, if
yes,
I may? We are beginning to celebrate 11 o'clock today. And it's your choice, Mr. Chair, if you could recess maybe 5-10 minutes and come on over to celebrate. And I do deeply appreciate it, even if you could share a minute or two to make a small congratulatory address to the Korean American people in there.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll try
thank
to
you very
there.
Much. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Representative Matthews is on the way.
I'm sorry, that jerky.
What's that?
Where
are
we
right
now?
Where can he get the jerky?
Representative Matthews. And just to kind of give you an update, we've talked about the bill already.
Oh, great.
And waited the last 10 minutes.
Well, thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Matthews, State Representative with House District 50, the great city of Gresham. Honor and privilege to be before your committee today, and I apologize that you're waiting on me. We apparently had a time schedule mishap there. House Bill 3630 is a product of what I believe to be good government. It's Multnomah County officials coming to their state electeds and saying, we have an issue that we'd like to address regarding our overcrowding and population of the jail system. And with some help from legislature, we could probably get there. It's not an unfunded mandate. It is something that sheriffs can do and can impose. And in Multnomah County's situation, they certainly will need to. Basically, this comes about because of when jails are overcrowded at 97%, they are into what they call forced release, which, let's be honest, our constituents don't like that. These are pretrial inmates that are released based on a standard of scoring. And I think that the average for Multnomah County, I believe, is about 42 from 2009. The score can go all the way to 1,000. Obviously, they only qualify if they fit in the 100 to 200. So the good news is we're not releasing a tremendous amount of dangerous folks, but the bad news is we are still releasing those folks pre-trial that have been accused and on hold for crimes they've committed, allegedly. What this does basically is this puts into place a responsibility, or at least the ability, for the sheriffs to monitor and supervise these folks under an early release condition. I believe this is in line with accountability in our system. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. It is a condition of release. The sheriff can impose it, and therefore the sheriff then can put them back into the system and withdraw that as well. I'm not sure if the sheriff will be here today, but the good news is we have the sheriff and the county commission and a lot of the electeds on board on this, and I don't believe there's any opposition. If there is, I've not been approached about that. This is a quick fix, and I think in the title alone, they just really are looking for statutory authority to legally supervise the forced release inmates. And I believe when I've talked about this through constituents at a town hall, they thought that this is just a great idea, because nobody really is a fan of opening the jail doors, as we've seen on the news, and they take off running out into the streets of Portland. So this is about Multnomah County, but available to all sheriffs that see the need in their counties.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say that it was really worth the wait.
Hey, thank you very much, Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Tough crowd here today.
Good to see you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3630. For anybody that's here regarding the Senate Bill 3508, that actually has gone over to Senate Bill, the LC 39 that the Senate heard earlier, and the work session they had on LC 39, so that we're not going to be bringing further to that. Is there any further business to come before the committee today? Committee adjourned.
Thank you
very much for being here. So.